Commerce Committee. Today we have a number of House bills. This is our first day of full-fledged hearing of House bills. Most of these bills, I believe, are agency-style bills involving the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
That's next week.
That's next week. I was doing my homework for next week. I saw Lou come in here. See, he threw me off.
Confusing.
All right, here we go. So, let's see. Order of preference. We're going to start a public hearing on House Bill 2254. Go right ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2254 imposes a 45-day timeline for an employer to provide copies or allow inspection of personnel records, allows a time extension upon the agreement of the employer and the employee, and establishes a civil penalty of up to $1,000 for violations. The members of the committee from last session might remember this is similar to Senate Bill 138, which passed our committee but got stuck in the House. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mark Zoltan and Elizabeth McKenna, please come forward.
Chair Pazansky, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Zoltan. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. As Anna Braun just said, House Bill 2254 is a very straightforward bill. Right now, there is no amount of time set forth in statute governing how long an employer has to respond to an employee's request for a personnel record. This bill would provide a 45-day time frame for the employer to respond to such a request. It would also allow the employer and the employee to mutually agree to extend that time frame beyond 45 days, and it would provide the Bureau the authority to impose a civil penalty should we receive a wage and hour complaint alleging that an employer has failed to meet the 45-day time frame. There is no remedy for this right now, but we do receive complaints from employees around the state about this. We've received 117 letters in the last two fiscal years, and we then send a letter to an employer urging them to provide the personnel record to the employee, but since there is no remedy and no civil penalty, there's nothing we can actually do beyond just encourage that behavior. So this would actually set that forth in statute. And the bill passed the House in March, 53-1. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you. Elizabeth.
Yes, my name is Elizabeth McKenna, Chair Pazansky, and the other senators. I'm an attorney. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers, and also all the clients whom I represent and have represented. I hate to tell you, this is my 30th year of practice, but I have found this to be a real problem. There are many. I've been in the labor and employment area virtually all of those years, and sometimes I've represented employers. Primarily, I represent now employees, but it is a problem. You send a letter. An employee comes in, and certainly I want to believe my client, but I also want to know what's in the file so I can make a competent assessment of whether or not there's a case there, whether I should be pursuing the claim on their behalf. And the one thing that's very helpful is to get an employment file. And so I will send a letter. Sometimes it comes, I would say probably more than 50% of the time the file comes. But there are times that there are things that are missing. There are times that the employers don't respond, particularly where you have an employer who has its corporate offices outside of the state, but the employee is employed in the state, governed by Oregon law. And so it's really important to bring those individuals to comply with the law. And there really is no way to do that except to file a lawsuit. And actually, I believe people have tried to file lawsuits and not been able to compel the file even then just for filing a claim on trying to compel the file. So you have to end up filing your lawsuit on behalf of the employee, and sometimes that's the first time you see the employee file. I think this will allow us to get the file initially. It defines in the statute what the file is, and if they don't provide it, then there's a civil penalty. Quite frankly, I think the civil penalty will be something that allows the employees or the employers to, or compels them, you know, to simply send the file. It's something an employee should be entitled to see. The 45 days, quite frankly, for those people who are willing to comply, they often comply before that time. It seems like a long time to us, but quite frankly, it's probably a fair time in order to be able to have some sanction if the employer is not willing to comply. It seems fair to give them 45 days, but if they don't comply in that time or they haven't arranged an extension, and I'm pretty reasonable, if they need 5 more days, they'll get 5 more days. But then we need to have a sanction and a way to compel them to provide that file. I think it will, may avoid some litigation. I think it's a fair bill, both for employees and employers. And I think it's a long time in coming, so I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Bakken first, and then Senator Beyer.
Certainly this applies to more than just situations involving litigation, but because employees, for a variety of reasons, might want to have a copy of their file. But I'm curious about the 45 days. That just seems like an extremely long period of time. Even if the employer houses their records out of state, it seems, you know, a week for the request, a week for sending it back, and you still have a month in between. How do you arrive at the 45 days?
Chair Pruszynski, Senator Bakken, I'm sorry, I really don't know how we arrived at the 45 days. I believe Commissioner Gardner settled upon that when we introduced the bill the last session and was trying to be reasonable, especially for corporations that were located out of state. I would agree with your assessment that I don't see how anybody could take longer than 45 days to access such records, but I guess there might be cases, but I really don't know how he settled on that exact figure. I'm sorry.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Subsection 3 of Section 1 talks about terminating employees, and the employer has to keep the record for 60 days, but the person, the employee, may request any time after that, if the employer has kept the record longer. What if they haven't kept the records longer and they don't respond?
I believe that if they haven't kept the records and they're being honest about it, which is it would be pretty rare in this day and age, I don't think then they're in violation of the law, and I defer to Bowley on that. But most people, most employers, keep the records because they simply, there are some requirements. Most employers have retention policies, and they'll keep them for a year or two or three, and with electronic means of keeping things, actually it's not much of a burden. So,
but what would happen? I mean, the employer doesn't have the records, it's beyond 60 days, and the employer says, well, lost is over 60 days, I'm not responding.
Chair Pruszynski, Senator Beyer, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question. Unfortunately, the legal policy advisor from the Bureau who is supposed to join me here today is not here, not present, and I'll have to get that answer for you. Sorry.
I think they would have the burden of proving that they do not have the records. But if they don't, if they can show they do not have the records and they did not have them when the request was sent, then I don't think they would be penalized.
All right. King answers the question.
Okay, this is what we're going to do on this one. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2254. Mark, if you could have your advisor, whoever, to be able to give us a little bit more information on that, answer those two questions, get them back to us, that'd be great.
Be happy to do so.
Also, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Have we established how many different employers are involved in that number of complaints?
Chair Pruszynski, excuse me, Senator Gordley, all I know is that we've received we sent out 117 letters over two fiscal years to employers. I would assume that most of those were to different employers, but I'm sure there might be some that were sent letters twice.
I'm just wondering if there are any patterns of concern. Okay.
I can check into that also.
Thank you.
I'm not aware of that.
And so you'll get that back to us too?
Correct.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on 2259. And looks like both of you are here to schedule to speak on it, and also Michael Wood. And Ms. Braun, why don't you give us the opening on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2259 increases the current time frame in which an employee may file a retaliation complaint under the Occupational Safety and Health Laws from 30 days to 90 days. It declares an emergency effective on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Whoever's going to go first, please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, for the record, Mark Zoltan, Legislative Affairs Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. House Bill 2259 would extend the current 30-day limit to 90 days for workers to file a complaint with the Bureau alleging retaliation for opposing a practice forbidden under the Oregon Safe Employment Act, for filing a complaint under the Oregon Safe Employment Act, for testifying about a safety or health violation, or exercising other rights protected under the Oregon Safe Employment Act. The Bureau, through its Civil Rights Division, is responsible for enforcing the prohibitions against discrimination under this act. Under current law, employees or prospective employees only have 30 days of time to file a complaint alleging retaliation regarding OSHA matters. All other civil rights matters allow a year for them to file complaints. So we feel this is a reasonable a step in the right direction to extend it to 90 days. And this bill was before the Senate Commerce Committee last session, and it passed the Oregon House this session by a vote of 59-0. Thank you. Who's next?
Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Wood. I am the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which we refer to as Oregon OSHA. And I'm here today to indicate our support for House Bill 2259. As indicated, BOLI is responsible for the enforcement of the discrimination provisions of the Oregon Safe Employment Act. Of course, that is the law that we enforce. And as you can see in my written comments in a little bit more detail, one of the critical features we feel of any enforcement program, of any effective state occupational safety and health program, is that employees have to have the belief that they can raise concerns, if necessary, with the agency responsible for enforcing those issues. They have to be able to talk to us. They have to, at times, be able to file complaints with us and respond honestly and openly when they're being interviewed by my staff. That measure of protection, or one of those measures of protection, is the discrimination protection that is enforced by the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We do see it as a problem that in the current law, it is a relatively short window in which an employee must file his or her complaint, the 30-day window. In some cases, frankly, that is less time than we take completing the inspection. A moment ago, you were talking about a 45-day response time for providing records. It's not out of the question that an employee might want to see those employment records in order to determine whether or not they have a valid complaint for discrimination under the Safe Employment Act. Extending the filing period to 90 days will relieve some of that pressure, but it will not be so long that memories fade or witnesses move away. We really think that the passage of this bill would allow more workers who believe they've been victims of discrimination to have their complaints given fair consideration by BOLI. And we also believe it would enhance the overall effectiveness of our program and of the Oregon Safe Employment Act in providing protection to workers. For those reasons, we support the bill. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Does this bill change the way public records requests are handled? What can be disclosed under a public records request?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Gordley, Michael is welcome to jump in here. I don't believe it changes any of the rules regarding public records that I'm aware of.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to that?
You may.
In my initial SMS, I did write that up about the public records request provisions, and after reviewing it more, I just see that the statute's been rewritten, and it's not. It's talking about, instead of public reports and public meetings, the citation, that's what it is currently. It's changing it to inspection of public records. So I think it's the same. It's just kind of a cleaner way to do that.
Okay. Appreciate that.
Sorry.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Byer, are you okay on this at this point?
I'll listen to the next testimony.
Okay. Ms. McKenna?
My name is Elizabeth McKenna. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers, and I'm also a private attorney and represent employees at this time. I've also represented employers in the past. I believe that this bill is very important, and it's a long time coming. As you may know, in order to file a claim for any kind of discrimination or retaliation, typically under the other statutes of the Oregon Chapter 659, you have a full year in which to file that claim. And many people, victims of retaliation for reporting unsafe work conditions, have assumed that they also have a year. Lawyers have sometimes assumed that those victims have a year. And it is simply inconsistent, but also a trap for individuals to think they must run out and file the claim within 30 days. And I expect that many individuals who feel they are retaliated against have not been able to pursue a claim. And this is a very important right. It's critical because we're encouraging or trying to encourage people to report unsafe work conditions, ones that may injure other employees and injure themselves and cause injury possibly even to the public in other ways. And retaliation does sometimes occur, unfortunately, and these individuals need protection. And for to require them to come to Boley and to learn about the Bureau of Labor and Industries within 30 days is simply unrealistic. The other aspect of this is retaliation is often an ongoing kind of process, and sometimes they are retaliated against over several months or even longer. They would try to argue, of course, that it's been an ongoing violation, but sometimes the most egregious things have occurred shortly after they reported, and they were too afraid to go in and report, and finally they get up the nerve after a month or two or three of this ongoing process, and sometimes the compensation that they may be able to get in court is not related to the most egregious violation, which occurred shortly after they made the complaint about to OSHA. And so I think it's important. Quite frankly, I think it would make sense to make it a year. In this case, it is unclear why it's only 90 days, but the expansion to 90 days in this day and age is simply the minimum that we think is essential for this kind of right to be protected. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Lockin.
Once again, I don't understand why the 90 days. I don't understand why in this particular area of employment law we've carved out a different time limit than in virtually all other areas of employment law, which is 1 year. There might be a reason for it. I just don't know.
Chair Pozanski, Senator Vakian, I think the reason can be summed up as politics. This is the best that we could get as far as a compromise on the House side, and so we went for the 90 days. I agree with this. It's out of sync with the other civil rights statutes currently under law.
I was just making a compromise at 59-0. Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair, I guess on the other side, we passed a bill of this committee a few months ago dealing with the other side of the OSHA issue, which is for the time for the employers to respond, and they had, under current law, 20 days and 10 days to respond to OSHA violations, and we made that better by going 30 and 20, which I think is going to be a big improvement if we can get that bill through the House, and I think hopefully we will. But in this case, we're going to triple the amount of time, I think if we would have talked about tripling the amount of time for the employer side, it would have been considered unreasonable. And so I'm looking for some fairness, to go from 30 to 90 is a big change for the employer side of it.
Well, I would like to add something to that. I mean, it's a fair comment, I think, Senator, for you to make, but I think one of them is dealing with the response to government action because of some violation. The other is dealing with the statute of limitations for somebody who's been harmed. So I think they're two different, and I would view them as completely different types of situations.
Chair Pruszynski, Senator Beyer, if I may, the clock also starts at a different time. If an employee complains, prompting an OSHA inspection, and then the employer, upset at that inspection, engages in some retaliation as a result of that, although the employee has at some point probably been advised of their rights, and there's a poster on the wall that indicates their rights, there's no clear notification frequently to them until at the end of the process when they receive notification from Oregon OSHA about the findings in the complaint, where we reiterate that if they're discriminated against, they have the opportunity to file a claim. At that point, the 30-day clock has been running since they had reason to believe that they were discriminated against, which may have been very early in the inspection. The 20-day, which would become a 30-day clock for appeals for employers, doesn't run until they receive a copy of the citation, which, of course, happens after the inspection has been completed. So when you look at the two parallel tracks, they're actually in closer alignment with the longer period of time. And, frankly, the employer also receives much clearer and much better notification of his or her rights to appeal because they always receive the citation and it always includes that written information at the time of citation.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, have we established how much of a problem this is? How many complainants have discovered that they were that they missed the timeline?
Senator Pruszynski, Senator Gordley, I don't have numbers on how many folks have missed the deadline.
Chair Pruszynski, Senator Gordley, we also don't have actual numbers, but we do know that it is not unusual for us to be having a conversation with a complainant late in the process where they indicate that something occurred early on. And sometimes these aren't even during the inspection. It may be several months later when they've corresponded with us about something. We realize that that could represent an allegation of discrimination, advise them that there may be an issue with the 30-day time frame, and encourage them to contact BOLI anyway. But we know that there are some significant number of those that simply get lost because they realize at that point that the clock has tolled and that they no longer have an opportunity to file the complaint.
I also address that, Chair Pruszynski and Senators. I would say that the average, the person coming in who has been terminated, and which is probably the most egregious form of retaliation for filing an OSHA complaint, they call right away, but often they are trying to find a job. They are dealing with the humiliation and embarrassment of having lost a job. It takes them a while to come in, and some people don't come in for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months or longer. And I can tell you in my practice, I have talked to many people, clients who have come in, and I said, well, there's no claim there. It's simply too late, at least in terms of going to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And we really need a longer time. I agree a year would be appropriate because sometimes they get confused. They read the BOLI regs, not that the BOLI regs aren't clear, but they look and they say, oh, I have a year to file, and this one is short. And there's no real rhyme or reason, but it is short, and at least we need it for 90 days. So thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing.
I'm going to ask if anybody else.
Oh.
I don't know. Other people came in.
Yeah, we should be checking. We got the list up here. Some other people have come in. Was there anyone else? Y'all are excused. Thank you. Does anyone else want to speak on House Bill 2253? Mark, you can stay there because you're going to be coming up next. All right, we'll close the public hearing on 2253. We're opening a public hearing on, 2259. And we're opening a public hearing on 2253. And, Mark, you're the only one I have listed for this one.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2253 consolidates laws governing investigations by the Bureau of Labor and Industries, Wage and Hour Commission, and State Apprenticeship and Training Council, clarifies ability of these agencies to seek court enforcement of subpoenas prior to the filing of a formal complaint. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Posansky, members of the committee, for the record, Mark Sultan, Legislative Affairs Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I'm joined by Marsha Ola Miller, the Bureau's Legal Policy Advisor. House Bill 2253 would give the Bureau authority to enforce its investigative subpoenas. Most regulatory agencies, including BOLI, have statutory authority to issue subpoenas to investigate compliance with laws they enforce and to require production of evidence for contested cases. The Oregon Administrative Procedures Act, the APA, provides authority for state agencies, including BOLI, to compel compliance with subpoenas for evidence in contested cases by petitioning a state circuit court for enforcement. However, the APA does not provide authority for agencies to enforce compliance with investigative subpoenas. Some of the other entities or agencies that already have this statutory authority to enforce their investigative subpoenas include Department of Human Services, Department of Justice, Secretary of State, Real Estate Commissioner, Employment Relations Board, Oregon State Bar, et cetera. I won't go through the entire list, but it is quite lengthy. As a result of BOLI not having this authority, it is necessary for the Bureau to file a lawsuit against an individual or entity that fails to comply with the Bureau's investigative subpoena in order to ask a court to enforce it. This is a needless and expensive and time-consuming process. A recent example of this, last spring, the Bureau investigated a complaint alleging violation of the state's wage and hour laws. In order to compel the firm's out-of-state owner to turn over payroll records, the Bureau was forced by its lack of subpoena enforcement authority to go to the circuit court on three different occasions for enforcement of its order. The Bureau had to pay the Department of Justice, who work, of course, as our attorneys, more than $7,000 for their work to get the subpoena enforced in court. The ability to prosecute the case was delayed by nearly 6 months. Our investigator had to spend 85 hours working on his case. Ultimately, to obtain judgments against the firm to cover the $22,000 paid to workers who did not receive their pay, we had to spend almost $10,000 in taxpayer money just to merely enforce the subpoena. We don't feel this is a good use of taxpayer funds or an efficient one. We would just urge your passage of House Bill 2253 as a straightforward fix to this oversight. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Gordley.
What you just referred to as an oversight must have some history attached to it. What is the history? How is it that this authority has not been included?
Vice Chair Byer, Senator Gordley, I'm going to have Marsha Olamiller, who's done some research, try to answer that question for you. Thank you.
Vice Chair Byer, Senator Gordley, I'm Marsha Ole Miller. I'm the Legal Policy Advisor of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We are not aware of how this came to be. We are aware that we trip over it periodically when we are trying to enforce an investigative subpoena because our counsel at Department of Justice tells us that the only way they can enforce an investigative subpoena is to file a lawsuit. The procedural groundwork is simply not there in the statutes, and I think part of that could be if you look at the bill, it would be necessary to put this wording into several different places. For instance, the Bureau of Labor and Industries has connected with it the Wage and Hour Commission, which is statutorily authorized to deal with certain matters. We have the Apprenticeship and Training Council, which deals with other matters before the Bureau. And there are several different places or entities associated with the Bureau that might be in an investigative mode. And so each one of those would really need language saying that they can enforce their investigative subpoenas in court. And that language simply is not there. There's an overriding statute, 651060, that spells out the duties and powers of the commissioner, which, you know, if all the language could have been put there, that would have been good, but it's not there either. So it's been a piecemeal thing. And as Mark stated, there is authority to enforce contested case subpoenas because, like all the other agencies who conduct contested cases, we're under the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act, and that has it spelled out. If you're an agency that does contested cases and you're having trouble enforcing a subpoena, here's how it's done, and that applies to a number of agencies. So there doesn't seem to be a history of someone intending that the Bureau not have this. It just seems to have not gotten into the statutes.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
This looks to me like by Section 1, Subsection 1, it's a broadening because under current law, you've got listed certain statutes you have the authority to issue these subpoenas. Subpoenas, you could take them, an administrative oath. And the statutes are specific. This says all of Chapter 652, 653, 658, and 659A. So that seems like it's quite a broadening of the power for BOLI.
Is that a question, sir?
It is a question.
Vice Chair Beyer, if you look at the statutes that are the citations that are being removed, it is essentially the same list of statutes. There is no intention to enlarge the chapters over which BOLI has authority. We currently have authority over all of those chapters, enforcement authority, that are listed there. And as far as the verbiage in here, I can tell you from being involved in this bill in the last legislative session that that was carefully put together to address the concerns of some people interested in the bill that everything be spelled out in here so that, for one thing, it requires us to adopt rules. Not all agencies are required to adopt rules regarding this, but we will be. And it will spell out the procedures through which they could object to providing the information, and it will have procedural safeguards that we would be required to adopt. So I don't think it enlarges our, I'm sure it does enlarge our statutory authority in any way, and as far as giving us additional powers with respect to subpoenas, actually what it does is give us additional safeguards with respect to wielding subpoena authority. That's my understanding of the bill.
Well, I guess I will go back and look, but, you know, under current law it says you have the power under subsection 1 of section 1. Like, if, for instance, in chapter 652, only for 652.330. And this bill, as drafted, would give you that power under all of Chapter 652. And again, with Chapter 653, under current law, it's only Chapter 653.055. And this bill would grant you that power for all of Chapter 653.
Vice Chair Beyer, if you look in Chapter 652 and 653 of the ORS, there are other subsections in addition to those listed in the language that's being removed that BOLI does have current authority over. So there are other things that previously could have been listed here and were not. So that's what I know about that language.
I understand it, but my question, yes, but the way I'm reading this, the commissioner only has the power to issue the subpoenas for enforcement of those specific statutes in 652 and 653, for instance. But this bill will give them that power to enforce all of Chapter 652 and 653.
Well, if you look at the actual language, Vice Chair Beyer, it says, starting on line 6, the commissioner may conduct investigations, issue subpoenas, etc., and take testimony in all matters relating to the duties required under, and it has the list of statutes. We have to have duties required under those chapters in order for us to wield any of those authorities, including the power of subpoena. This doesn't give us any new authorities in those chapters. It simply says where we have duties required under those chapters, then this would apply. That would be my interpretation or understanding of this.
Well, I guess that'll have to be investigated further, because the way I read this, you only have that power now. You may have other power under Chapter 652, but you only have the power to issue subpoenas and administer oaths, obtain evidence, and take testimony in 652.330, not in the rest of 652 under current law. But with this bill, you'd have it under all of Chapter 652. Same with Chapter 653.
I'd like to join you with that request. I'd like a more specific response.
You understand my question?
I understand your question, and I've given you as specific as a response as I'm capable on this occasion. I would be happy to go through this and address it in writing and answer that question.
Absolutely. The bill's not moving today, so we'll give you an opportunity to find out what these expanded chapters that you are going to be now have this power to issue subpoenas for, you know, what they are or what they may do. So please get back to us in writing or back to the committee administrator so all of us can get it.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2253? Seeing no one, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2253. Open a public hearing on... Oh, yes. For people here for House Bill 2220, apparently that bill has amendments that's not in yet and waiting, so that bill will not be done today. We will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2260. And, Anna, if you would introduce it while I'm looking for the list.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. House Bill 2260 allows compensatory and punitive damages and other relief for unlawful employment practices based on race, religion, color, sex, national origin, marital status, or age.
Yes, thank you. Mark and Liz, they're both here ready, so go ahead, Mark, your first.
Vice Chair Beyer, members of the committee, once again, for the record, Mark Zoltan, Legislative Affairs Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. As the members of the committee know, already know, Oregon has a proud history when it comes to civil rights protection for race, color, national origin, and religion. We actually had our own statute prior to the federal government. Ours was enacted in 1949, while the Federal Civil Rights Act, of course, was enacted in 1964. Given that proud and rich history, House Bill 2260 appropriately proposes extending the meaningful remedies since enacted for other state civil rights violations so that victims are not required to bring actions under the federal law if they want real compensation. This bill proposes to align the remedies available for employment discrimination based on an employee's protected class with those that are already available for similar types of discrimination. It's also important to point out that Oregon employees of employers with fewer than 15 employees do not have access to federal remedies at all. For example, the law already provides this compensatory damage remedy for those who are victims of discrimination in real estate transactions based on a protected class and those who are discriminated against based upon a disability or for exercising their workers' compensation rights. Employment discrimination due to an employee's protected class is equally as improper as other types of discrimination. The law should reflect that and allow recovery of similar damages. Current law only allows the court to award injunctive or equitable relief, but no compensatory damages. This bill would enable those who suffer employment discrimination based on a protected class to recover $200 or actual compensatory damages. It would also allow recovery of punitive damages if the employee can meet the test required by law to plead these damages. House Bill 2260 passed the Oregon House on March 7th by a vote of 54-0, and we urge you to pass this bill out of committee. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, General. Was this one also around last session?
Yes, sir, it was.
Passed the Senate, died in the House?
Correct.
Go ahead, Liz.
I'm, for the record, Elizabeth McKenna. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers, and also I'm a private attorney representing employees now. I have also represented employers, Vice Chair Beyer and Honorable Senators. It is a pleasure to be here and talk with you about this bill. It's a fairly simple change. There's just one one statute that's moved to a different section. It's, I think, probably nothing short of ironic that you have a bill or a law in this state that has that deals with discrimination, essentially prohibits discrimination in employment, and the bill itself currently, as it's written, the law, discriminates against victims of discrimination. I mean, it's too early for your vote, but if I had to ask you to vote, who of you thinks that an individual who is suffering, who has been discriminated against based on race, would have less humiliation, less loss of self-esteem, less loss of dignity than an individual who is a victim of disability discrimination?
or whoever you would think, than an individual who is suffers from and is a victim of sex discrimination would have less loss of self-esteem, humiliation, emotional distress, damage, than someone who has asserted a workers' compensation claim and been retaliated against for that. But that's exactly what the law currently provides. It has different levels of compensation and remedies for individuals who are victims of discrimination based on different categories. Now, I'm not suggesting that the legislature discriminated. What has happened, and you ask, how did this come about? And the Bureau of Labor representative has talked some about that. Oregon was a leader. In 1949, it passed this law and said, if you are a victim of discrimination, you should have some remedy. And that was progressive, and it allowed a remedy. And the state has always said, we do not want to, since that time, we do not want to discriminate. And they have allowed individuals who are victims to get out-of-pocket recovery, their loss of wages, and possibly loss of future wages. But then in 1964, the federal law of Congress followed Oregon, I guess you could say, and passed a similar type of statute and said you're limited, you get your wages. At that time, the federal law did not provide for pain and suffering damages. It didn't provide for punitive damages to punish the employer. But somehow, the federal law and the vast majority of states have leaped ahead of Oregon in this crucial area. They have allowed for compensatory damages. The federal government changed their law, Congress changed the law in 1991, shortly after the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings, and it wasn't coincidental, I believe. And also, states who have passed these laws, the majority of states at least, provide for compensatory damages. Now, in our state, we have passed legislation since then dealing with discrimination based on a disability. And when that legislation was passed, adequate remedies, compensating people for the emotional distress damage, if it's there, and punitive damages, if it's appropriate. They've passed it and included those remedies. And that's true with the also the law that prohibits discrimination based on a person filing a workers' comp claim or other kinds of a whistleblower, a person who files a civil or criminal statute proceeding and the employer retaliates against them for that, is awarded this full remedy. But those victims of race, sex, national origin, religion, and age are only entitled to wages. They're only entitled to get their past wages and future pay, front pay, if they can prove that they will have loss of pay in the future. And it simply is inequitable. And it's time for Oregon to make its statutes uniform within themselves. But it's also time to allow Oregon citizens to have adequate remedies with those provided to individuals who are citizens of other states. And it is a simple change. One of the things that's very...
Senator Vaca has a question.
Oh, yes.
Because of that disparity that you just described, when you file a lawsuit on behalf of somebody, what do you do in order to be able to claim the other types of damages? And I might note, too, you don't have to be quite so close to the microphone.
Okay, all right. I have a loud voice. I could rather do that. Okay. I want to be able to hear you, but I could just talk like I normally do. Thank you. You do one of two things. You either add other types of claims that are possibly some sort of intentional infliction of emotional distress claim or some other claim that you think might fit, but it doesn't always fit. And often those claims are dismissed, and you don't have a claim for compensatory damages, at least in state court. The other option is to file in federal court if you can meet the criteria for filing in federal court. That is not certainly a good option for many people. It is more expensive. It takes longer. It currently, I would say, I estimate twice as long in federal court. It's more formal and more burdensome for everyone involved. That's from the employer side and the employee side. It is more complicated and more complex to have to do that. And in any event, Oregon law ought to be providing a remedy for individuals, for its citizens, and for its victims of discrimination. And there's one thing I would point out, and I'm not so sophisticated in this testimony, but this actually could be a revenue-generating bill. Let me just explain how. By providing for punitive damages for these types of claims, and these probably make up the vast majority of discrimination claims, when you have an award of punitive damages in state court, 60%, and that's not 1-6, that's 6-0, 60% of that goes back to the state to compensate victims, crime victims and other victims. So there's a victims compensation fund. So in fact, it would allow that fund to have more in its coffers if in fact there were punitive damages allowed. But for the reasons that I've suggested, to have equity within the law and equity for the citizens of Oregon along in comparison to those in other states, we urge you to make this change. It's a long time in coming. Certainly, we should be the leader again, or at least at par with other states and with the federal law. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2260? Ms. Trussell, come forward.
I know what she's going to want. She's going to want to stop that punitive damages thing like 80% so that it brings in a little more money for the state.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and we're here in opposition to House Bill 2260. And I think that the comments I'm going to make have been made in the previous by two of the previous witnesses, but I'm using them as arguments of why it's not necessary. Both the Labor Commissioner and the federal court, or if you file a federal claim, you can get these sorts of damages. So what this bill is targeted at is the state courts, allowing them to award the same types of damages that the commissioner can or that the federal courts can award. Also, it's my understanding, and I'm not an attorney, so and she apparently, she obviously is, but it's my understanding that you can file a federal claim in the state courts. You don't have to file it in the federal court. So that remedy is available. And what we see the biggest impact on this for is Oregon small employers, because everybody who has 15 or more employees already is subject to the federal penalties and remedies. So what this will impact primarily for Oregon are the employers that have up to 15 because they currently aren't subject to the federal requirements. So for those reasons, we think there's adequate remedies both by using either the federal system or going through the commissioner without adding additional. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Monroe.
Did you oppose this bill in the House?
Yes, I did.
And it still got a unanimous vote?
It
you got a lot of clout,
did.
You know?
Thank you. That was nasty.
Thank you. I may not have heard this if you said it, but have we established how many states are Oregon is among how many states that haven't done this yet?
Yes, Vice Chair Beyer and Senator Gourley, I looked at some treatises and I didn't do an up-to-date search of every, but in 2006 there were essentially 60% of the states that allow compensatory damages, so it's majority, that healthy majority.
All right. Okay. I'm going to say this to Ms. Trussell, and with all due respect, please don't take this personally, but I would like you to take this message back to your organization. I am someone who sits here very much aware, very mindful of the history of our state and the struggles that we've had around discrimination in a number of forms. And I'm aware of the history and the struggles that took us to the victory in 49 and the other victory in 53 that enacted the public accommodations law. And I have to tell you that I find it disappointing, so disappointing, deeply disappointing, that AOI would be in opposition to this measure. Not only do I find it deeply disappointing, I'm also going to take it a step further and tell you that I'm personally offended. Please take that to your organization and share it. You know, yours is an organization that a couple of sessions ago stepped up and assisted us in making sure that a portrait, a photograph now hangs outside of the House chamber commemorating the signing of the public accommodations law. Your organization helped us do that. And that was a remarkable moment, and it was a remarkable collaboration as well. I say this with some emotion. I have to admit to that. Please take my comments back to your organization.
Mr. Vice Chair and Senator Gordley, I certainly will do that, and I hope you understand that AOI does not support discrimination. What we're opposed to is the remedies in this bill.
I can make the distinction. I can make that distinction, but I'm also one who's just very clear about how the law has been used in the history of our nation and our state.
Thank you.
To exclude and not include. And again, please don't take this personally, but it's coming from a place of understanding our history, but also understanding the moment that is in front of us.
Appreciate that.
That I would hope that we would all want to claim, that all of our institutions would want to claim and be identified with. That's where I'm coming from.
Thank you.
Senator Vaccaro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up to the exchange that we just heard. The civil rights statutes are nothing without both the sufficiency and the equality of the remedy.
Yes.
But beyond that, I frankly am just kind of surprised by AOI's position, because I asked the question of Ms. McKenna of what lawyers do with this statute the way it currently is. The answer she gave, I believe, is exactly right. They file other types of claims in order to get at those damages, or they bring it to federal court, both of which make litigation more complex, much more expensive for the employer, and frankly, in federal court, sometimes harder for the employer to win. And so the best thing that a business in Oregon can do is to support this statute, because it'll make your litigation more expensive and easier. So I'm just a little bit surprised at the position.
Mr. Vice Chair and Senator Avakian, I think that one of the concerns is that it will make litigation more expensive, and as I think it was testified to, is that they expect there'll be an increase of claims filed.
Maybe I misspoke. If I did, I'm sorry for that. I cannot see any fathomable way that litigation becomes more expensive with this bill. And I see every way in the world it becomes more streamlined, less expensive, and in state court rather than federal court, which is more expensive for your clients. I don't understand the position.
Is it appropriate? Could I respond to that?
It's up to the chair.
Well,
chair.
Vice Chair, excuse me.
I guess the only thing is, we've already, and I don't know if you'd like to clarify whether or not these federal cases can be filed in state court now.
I would. That's what
I... And that's if you want to respond to that part of it, because I don't know the answer to that.
Yes, Vice Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. Federal claims can be filed in state court along with state court claims, and in 99% of those times, the employer, the defendant,
removes it to federal court, and that's an automatic removal. If you include a federal claim, they have a right, an automatic right, to file a petition for removal, and you can't oppose it unless you drop your federal claim. So it does end up in federal court. I think I have one case filed now, and it's been a long time, which I filed in state court, included a federal claim, and quite frankly, I think they just missed the 30-day timeline to remove it, or otherwise they would have removed it also. And then it does become more expensive and more complicated. And even in state court, if we have to try to get around this problem and file several other claims that sometimes they don't exactly fit, we end up taking a lot of time in court with motions to dismiss or summary judgment on those claims, and those probably wouldn't be included. It would be a much more streamlined case under Chapter 659 where it belongs. If it's a discrimination case, we ought to be able to plead it that way, and there ought to be an adequate and complete remedy for an individual who has suffered more than just wage loss. So, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Is anyone else? Unless there's any other questions or comments, is there anyone else who would like to testify? Seeing no one,
thanks.
Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2260 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2255. Ms. Braun.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2255 makes discrimination against an employee for filing a wage claim or reporting violations of working conditions, minimum wage, and overtime laws on unlawful employment practice, clarifies that compensatory damages are an available remedy. Thank you, Ms. Vice Chair.
And Mark.
Vice Chair Beyer, members of the committee, once again for the record, Mark Zoltan, Legislative Affairs Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. House Bill 2255 clarifies employers' responsibilities and employees' rights when an employee alleges retaliation for exercising his or her wage-related rights. Current law provides a whistleblower-type remedy for certain types of retaliation if there happens to be a criminal penalty associated with the wage-related right that the employee asserted. Current Oregon Statute 652.355 prohibits employers from discriminating against employees because the employee has made a wage claim or discussed, inquired, or consulted an attorney or agency about a wage claim, or if the employee has caused to be instituted, has testified, or is about to testify in any proceedings under or related to ORS 652.310. There is only a court remedy for those discriminated against under ORS 652.355. The remedy is actual out-of-pocket damages or $200, whichever is greater. There is no administrative remedy through BOLI or any other agency. Current ORS 653.060 prohibits employers from discriminating against an employee because the employee has made complaint that the employee has not been paid wages in accordance with minimum wage and employment condition law. The employee has or is about to cause to be instituted or has or about to testify in any proceedings under or related to Oregon Statute 653.010. There is, once again, no court or administrative remedy for those discriminated against under this statute. House Bill 2255 would amend both those statutes, ORS 652.355 and 060, to make violations of those statutes unlawful employment practices subject to the enforcement provisions of the civil rights statutes in ORS Chapter 659A. This is a much simpler enforcement scheme for complainants, employers, and the agency to work with and to track. House Bill 2255 passed the full House by a vote of 41-12, and we urge your passage of this bill. Thank you very much.
Questions from the committee? Senator Monroe.
Was this before the legislature 2 years ago?
Yes, sir, it was.
Passed the Senate, died in the House?
Correct.
Thank you. I see a pattern here.
Any other questions? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2255. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2943.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2943 It requires the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules for standards of professional conduct for those performing independent medical exams if the appropriate health professional regulatory board has not adopted standards. The rules shall be consistent with the published rules of the Independent Medical Examination Association. It declares an emergency, effective on passage. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. Jerry Magnahan.
Manahan
and Hasina Squires. John. Okay. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify in this bill? We got one more chair if there is. Go ahead, please, Jerry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jerry Manahan. I'm the deputy administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And you have written testimony by Mr. John Schiltz before you, and I'll try to reiterate the comments that he's made. Basically, House Bill 2943A comes about because of a bill that happened last session with Senate Bill 311. We're here in support of this bill. Senate Bill 311 last session established a process for the department to authorize physicians to be independent medical examiners. And with that process, the department goes through and we authorize a list of providers who may perform independent medical examinations under the workers' compensation system. As part of that process, the director can remove a physician from the list if they fail to provide services that are in violation of the code of conduct for those medical providers. Those are the conducts that are codes that are set up by their professional licensing board. Some professional boards do not have codes of conduct. Where that is the case, then the department uses those codes of conduct that are established by the American Board of Independent Medical Examiners. After the bill went into effect, the American Board of Medical Examiners, they have a copyright on their code of conduct. So as the bill went into effect, we are using the code of conduct from that board that were in effect January 1 of 2006. And because of the copyright issues, the department has gone through a process where we go through and we enter into an agreement with the American board to use their code of conduct. Subsequent to this, they have now told us that they would like to provide the training themselves for those standards or require all of the Oregon medical providers to actually enter and subscribe to their organization to provide their services. And generally when that happens, those Oregon providers will have to pay a fee to either take the training from that organization or a fee to belong to the organization. House Bill 2943A, it requires the director to adopt rules for the standard of conduct for any providers whose organization and whose board does not already have a code of conduct for that discipline. And the rules would be consistent with the code of conduct that's adopted by the Independent Medical Examination Association, which is a local association. And that association has identified with us that they do not have any copyright issues with their code of conduct. By looking at the code of conduct from that organization, we feel that their guidelines are clear, they're concise, they're enforceable. We think they're even maybe more effective than those of the American Board of Independent Medical Examiners. One of the problems we had is our current agreement with the American Board, it expires today. And so we have an emergency clause with this bill to allow us to adopt the rules and move forward. And the Management Labor Advisory Committee has reviewed this. They support the bill. And I'd be glad to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Hasina, we'll get your testimony first before questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer. I've been waiting to say that all session. Chair Beyer and members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Independent Medical Examination Association. As Jerry pointed out, our association is a local organization, statewide organization who represents the IME companies who facilitate IMEs. We also have a number of physicians and attorneys that belong as associate members to our organization. I think Jerry did a great job explaining what this bill is all about. Senate Bill 311 did require that the director certify IME providers on a list, and the director is also allowed to decertify those providers for violating the code of conduct, whichever code of conduct it is. It was put into the statute that it would be the ABIME code of conduct, actually at our suggestion, so I'll take responsibility for that. It's a national organization. We thought how fabulous that would be to put the ABIME code in there, and then subsequently found out that the ABIME wanted to charge the state of Oregon for either using the copyright or require people to go through their training in exchange for the use of the code of conduct. Our association does have a code of conduct, and as you heard Mr. Manahan explain, the workers' comp department believes that our code of conduct may actually be a little more stringent than the ABIME code of conduct. So we are happy to share our code of conduct with the state of Oregon free of charge and with no strings attached, and that's why we brought this bill forward. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? I've got a few. Senator Atkinson.
Well, he's a little taller and better looking, but I'll go ahead and ask the question. That's hard. It's easy to confuse us, I know.
George and Abe.
George Washington.
I have a few questions, and Mr. Schultz, you'd feel free to answer because I don't know who they should go to. I want to make sure I understand the language here. First of all, can any of you define for me what the intent is behind the word consistent with? Does it mean same as or something else? I'm sorry, line 14.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devakian, I am John Schultz, the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, part of Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm assuming you're looking at line 14. The rules adopted by the director under the subsection shall be consistent with the guidelines. My understanding of that is that we would adopt rules that would basically would take the IMEA standards and put them into our administrative rules as the standards of conduct to apply to independent medical examiners if their board did not have other
then
standards.
My next question, if I may have got three maybe, why do you need this in your rules? Why do you need the standard in your rules? Do you do some type of enforcement based on them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Avakian, yes, if there are complaints that injured workers or anyone, for that matter, would bring forward in regard to a violation of a code of conduct.
Complaints of an IME doctor.
Complaints about the conduct of an IME or about an IME doctor or something, we would look into that, investigate that, and we would. What we enforce is essentially whether or not that provider remains on the list and eligible for becoming an independent medical examination provider.
All right. Well, then this is what I need an explanation on from your agency. Because in line 14 it says that the rules that you adopt shall be those of the board. You have a state agency deferring the standards of its own regulatory authority to the very private industry that you are enforcing. To me, that would be the same, for instance, as this body crafting a statute on white-collar crime and then letting the white-collar criminals decide what the standard is that they need to be enforced by. So I don't understand why you're delegating your authority to craft rules to the very people that you are overseeing.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Vaki, and I may have misspoke. What our intention would be to go through a public rules promulgation process where we would put proposed rules together, including standard of conduct that would be consistent with those with the code of conduct from the Independent Medical Examination Association, but that then goes through a public process and input is gathered, and the outcome of that process is not a predetermined outcome.
Well, explain to me how under line 14 you could adopt a rule that is not consistent with what that industry wants.
Mr. Chair, Senator Vakian, I think the issue would probably come down to a particular code of conduct. Let's say one would be something like whether or not a person's report, an examiner's report, is going to be written to reflect an outcome that the person who's paying for the report wants. In other words, you know, undue influence in terms of the written report. What we would want to do is have a rules process that deals with that issue, that is consistent with addressing that issue. If the verbiage from the Independent Medical Examination Association is not appropriate as we go through the public process, and that is discovered, and people come to a consensus, or even, you know, that's actually quite rare sometimes, where there's disagreement and argument about that, then it would be up to the director to determine the rule language that would be necessary in terms of what kind of code of conduct we would want to adopt.
Well, let me jump here in a second. I think the in response to your question, that it's the code of conduct that was effective as the on the when this act goes into effect, if this was to pass. So if this was to pass and get signed by the governor, we can see what the code of conduct is. It's here. And I think the reasoning behind that, and I remember this discussion from last session, is that the Workers' Comp Board or the director of the Workers' Comp Division is not the expert on who should, on what IMEs, what their code of conduct should be. And they had no expertise at all in this. And in fact, the way I remember last session's bill, it started with the Board of Medical Examiners were going to present the
That's correct.
The code of conduct, and the Board of Medical Examiners objected to that, said, we don't have the expertise to say how these people should act. And that's why we went to the national board, but now we've got gardens there. So we can see what the standards are today, and it's not like these are going to change. If these change, the bill, the law, the rules wouldn't change.
I do understand that, and that's very, it's a very good point. I did read to the period in the sentence, and still, Mr. Chair, I just have great difficulty with a regular authority of the state deferring to the very people that they're regulating for the standards that are to be used in the regulation. And I find it very difficult to, well, that's exactly what the statute says, unless you can tell me different.
Yeah, let me.
And it would seem to me that you would have somebody within your department that would have some knowledge of what IME doctors do and don't do, since you've been overseeing this process for, I don't know, how many years, decades?
Let me make a comment. I apologize. I had to be at another meeting, so I didn't hear the beginning of the testimony. But the concerns that Senator Avakian has raised is one that I think is worthy of being addressed. Based on the language of the bill, it does, in fact, look like rules would be whatever the Independent Medical Examination Association would state, because it says shall be consistent with. I think the part that I heard what John was saying as to the process that's used with the public, having proposed rules going through the rulemaking process where people get to come and make public comment, and then at that point it seems to me the rules are adopted based on that. And so I think the terminology there isn't right, because I also have the same problem in another arena where government functions are being delegated to private entities. You know, OSAA is the one that I have looked at as to some of the issues that have been dealt with in that arena, and that is a nonprofit private entity that actually has, from my perspective, been given the authority of doing government functions. Now, I don't think that was the intent here, but I do believe the language that's currently, as it is proposed, makes it appear, if not outright require it, to be consistent with whatever is within the guidelines. So it seems to me that we need to have a little bit of work on this, make sure that we have the frame and the terminology appropriate to the point of where there's enough comfort in there to still allow for, let's call it, the expertise of the association to bring forward modeled rules or whatever it may be. But at the same time, there's got to be a decision that's made at the state level as to what the rules actually are, and it's not something that's going to be required or mandated to be consistent with another outside association. That's the take I'm getting. Senator Avakian, is that, would well, that give you more comfort?
It is, and I know that we've got issues around what may means and what shall means and, you know, such, but the permissive use of the word may, if it were to say something like may adopt the rules of, so that there was still discretion on behalf of the agency, would is something that would be, you know, fine with me.
Senator Byron, I know from the stuff we got from LC as to the may and the shalls and the shall not and may not. So we'll make sure we get that taken care of. I understand from our administrator that these rules that are currently in place are kind of like on the last hour, and we need to move this forward as quickly as possible. With that in mind, I'd like for us to get together as quickly as possible with the administrator and make certain we get the appropriate language to make it consistent with the process that we've got.
And Mr. Chair, in terms of just clarifying our understanding, and understanding the issue with inappropriate delegation of state authority, I definitely hear what you're saying. What we were trying to do here was to adopt rules that were consistent with the code of conduct that was in effect at this time, which we have reviewed, felt it was actually a better code of conduct than what we had had before. It seems, though, that the issue that you're concerned with is more of the shall.
The issue is this: 10 years from now, that might not be adequate, and you're going to be bound by a statute that says that's all you've got. And so your agency needs the ability to adopt these standards now if you want to, but to later not be bound by them if they're not appropriate.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
All right, other questions? I'm sorry, Senator.
No, you're committee.
Yeah, well, you have the gavel.
Is there anyone else who'd like to testify in this bill? Seeing no one, any other questions? Close the public hearing. And, Mr. Chair, we've gone through all the public hearings.
Thank you, committee members, and we'll go ahead and adjourn us out. Senator Byron, that'd be great.
Commerce is adjourned.